other committee that's at the same time.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the Joint Interim Committee on the Department of Energy Oversight to order this morning. We have an agenda today that we're going to be looking at the Director's Office and Central Services, and also going to be having a little bit of time for public comment. And we'll talk a little bit about next steps as well. So with that, I think I'm going to, unless the committee has anything to offer, we'll just jump right into having the Director, Mike Kaplan, come up and speak to us about the office, Director's Office and Central Services. Morning on this Monday, and welcome back.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Kaplan, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm joined today by Blake Johnson, our Chief Operations Officer. Together, we'll be presenting the administrative services of the Oregon Department of Energy. We think we'll be relatively brief. We'll quickly review the structure and purpose of administrative services at ODO, and then focus primarily on information technology and on the energy supplier assessment. As you can see on the screen, administrative services covers the director's office and the central services division of the agency. Altogether, there are 38 staff positions and 37.5 FTE. These positions are dedicated to supporting all of the rest of the work that you've heard about from the department over the last 6 months. They also include the governor's energy policy advisor and two positions on the Power and Conservation Council. Administrative services accounts for a little bit more than 32% of the agency's operating budget. We've broken that down by funding stream on the screen here. Primarily, central services is funded by fee recovery, or an indirect model that's approved by the federal government. That model allows central services to bill out to other divisions in the agency for the services it provides. The director's office, as you can see, is funded primarily by energy supplier assessment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
A couple of questions come to mind. First, 32% administrative is quite high. It looks like almost 40% of your FTE are administration. So the question is, you also have your FSEC and your other four areas of within your agency. Do each of those also have a administrator, like an executive administrator position in those, and is that included in this 32%?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, each of the divisions does have a division administrator. That's correct. That is not included in this number. And again, the 32% is of our operating budget, not our total budget. So out of our total budget, that share of administrative services is actually below 10%.
With respect, you've got a lot of unlimited funds in your budget that has little to do with the operation. So we're looking at somewhere 32% plus at least four other executive administrators. You must be getting up close to 40% of administrative cost.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, all of our executive leadership in the agency are also working managers. So I guess you could also attribute those to administration of the division, but in nuclear safety and in FSEC and our policy and innovation division, they are also performing the functions of those particular divisions as well. So it's not strictly management in each of those cases.
Okay. One follow-up question.
Follow-up.
Regarding to the governor's policy advisor, how much is that individual paid? How long has the that position been paid by the Department of Energy, and how did that come to pass?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, I believe that the position first appeared in ODO's budget in 2011. It is a PEMF position, so it's sort of higher up on the management. As far as the exact salary, I don't know offhand. We could certainly get you that cost after the hearing.
It's been for the last 5 years, ODO has paid that position for the governor's office.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, 2011 is the first time that I know that it appeared in the budget. That's correct.
Thank you, Mike.
I suspect it was before that.
As I'm sure you can guess, and is consistent with every other organization, our administrative services include financial operations, facilities, HR, internal audit, communication, government relations, and information technology. And although we've just addressed it, the governor's energy policy advisor is in our budget and funded with ESA. The two positions for the Northwest Power and Conservation Council are funded via pass-through directly from the council. So although they sit on our budget, they are not actually paid for with resources from the agency.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, go ahead.
So though they're monies that are not that come from BPA, the pass-through, is that reflected in the operating budget numbers?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, yes, that's correct.
Okay, so those two members are that their salaries and personnel costs are included in that number?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, yeah, right, and they're offset on the revenue side, so you would not see them. That's correct.
So they are in there.
They pay for the policy advisor.
Pays for the policy advisor and the two council members.
So with that,
Mr. Co-Chair, do we still have more discussion on that you'd like to share with the committee, or are you done?
We're done. I'm sorry.
Thank you. With that very quick overview, I'll turn it over to Blake to walk you through the sections of the Central Services Division.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Blake Johnson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer and also the Central Services Division Coordinator Administrator. Before I get started, I just want to know that these slides I'm going to present and the words I'm going to tell you do not really do service to these folks. They do a lot more than what I'm going to tell you right now. Central Services is really the backbone of the agency, and like the backbone, when everything's working well, no one seems to notice. It's kind of invisible, but they do get noticed when things go wrong, and so they tend to get more criticism than they do kudos, but I thought I'd just start off with that. So my budget team is 3 FTE. They prepare, execute, and monitor, and do all the heavy lifting for the agency's budget from start to finish for every biennium. This is also a team responsible for identifying all of the reduction options we've taken to keep the agency's budget as tight as possible over the last couple biennium. They helped identify more than $50 million in cuts we implemented for this biennium. In addition, our budget team, we have an accounting staff of 4 FTE. As you can see on the screen, this team handles a wide range of responsibilities. Continuing through our finance and operations, our contracts and procurement team includes 3 FTE. This team handles a large volume of procurements, solicitations, agreements, and purchasing for the agency. We also have one federal grant manager who monitors several of our federal grants, but primarily the State Energy Program, or SEP, grant. Our facilities team includes 2 full-time receptionists who handle a large number of incoming calls and help schedule or transfer our transfer of records to state archives and also manage our fleet of DAS vehicles. We also have a half FTE related to building management. This team has been very busy over the past 2 years as our rented building is not in the best of shape. We have also consolidated 3 offices into 1 to cut costs and to bring our team closer together. We also currently working on moving to a state-owned building.
Mr. Co-Chair, go ahead.
Excuse me. The building maintenance, is that a DAS contract?
Chair Holvey, Senator Beyer, no, it's not. Well, it is not. We contract with the church who owns our building.
So you don't have the advantage of DAS's management services on that?
Chair Holvey, Senator Beyer, we do not. They helped us negotiate the contract, but we work directly with the building management with the church, the owners.
It's a fairly unusual structure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So as I stated, we are currently in the process of moving to a different building, the old PUC building. We hope to be moved in by November, December of this year, as our lease is expiring this year. Now I'll quickly switch to the teams in our director's office. We have our human resources team is 3 FTE. As you can see, they have focused their energies on significantly improving our HR functions at the department. We've expanded our recruiting, updated our policies, conducted a desk audit of every EDS employee, and continue to work to provide more effective and efficient HR services to staff. We also have an internal audit position. Prior to 2014, the agency had been without an auditor for a significant period of time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The with your director's office, the and human relations, somewhere in this presentation, it indicates that you have changed your virtually 110% of your staff. Over, it didn't say over what period of time. I wonder what period of time that would be. And I would wonder if the hiring and firing of this hiring and whatever of the staff has had is done by the by your human relations people, or is it being done by DAS?
Chair Holvey, Senator Whitsitt, absolutely. We've had 110% turnover in about the last 5 years, about 20% turnover in the last year, and our HR staff handles all of the recruitments. In the past, we have had several failed recruitments for some of our higher level staff, like the OPA 4s, Operations Policy Analyst 4s. But recently, we've been very successful because our HR has done further outreach and cast a wider net. So we've been successful recently.
Thank you.
We have one internal audit position. As I said, prior to 2014, the agency had been without an internal auditor for a significant period of time. Since this hire, however, we've conducted two risk assessments within the department, stood up an audit committee, and identified and developed several process improvements.
Mr. Chair. Co-chair Byer.
So the internal audit, is that focused at your grant and tax credit programs? Is risk management, is that what that's about?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Byer, it's focused on the entire agency. Obviously, completing the risk assessment allows us to prioritize where we want to focus that attention. It is just one FTE. Primarily, it has been focused on the incentive side of the shop, although there are also DAS-mandated audits that we have to conduct on a regular basis. So it's sort of a combination of both of those.
Has that helped you identify some of the problem areas that you've been speaking about correcting for the last couple of months?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Byer, they certainly have, especially the risk assessments, which let us know where we should focus our attention. But that even in the chances where we don't have an opportunity to audit those areas, they do show vulnerabilities, which we have flagged for you and a variety of other bodies over the course of the last couple of years.
Thank you, Mike. Mm-hmm.
Could I follow up on that for a minute?
Thank Senator Whitsitt.
In previous meetings, we've talked a little about the repricing of tax credits to make them more saleable. And it's my understanding that you had indicated that there was some legal risk there. I would assume that this internal audit position is looking at that. But what I was wondering, as you know, after some reflection, it seems that the rules and published pass-through rates were obvious when the applications were made. The applications were pre-certified. So somewhere in the presentation, I would hope that you could explain to us what the legal risk is for changing the agreement, for not changing the agreement after the fact. I mean, these people, when they made applications for the for tax credits, they knew what the rules were. They were told what it was printed, and so why would there be any legal risk for the state? Why would there be any legal risk exposure for not doing it, not changing the pricing now?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, we covered. We don't plan to get into that issue on this presentation. We covered that in the last hearing, but the risk is that the department for years gave out inconsistent information The rules were did not conform with agency practice, and management did not always communicate uniformly to staff who were communicating with project owners consistent messages. So we know that we have given applicants and participants in our tax credit program incorrect information for years. And they engaged in a process with information that, as it turns out, they could not rely on. So I believe that there is risk in that we have created a pattern of misinformation over time to the participants in our tax credit program.
And when did that pattern cease to happen?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, last year when we began to work on the rulemaking and communicating to our tax credit participants exactly the circumstances that they were in. It continued as we corrected the rates of pass-through, which we articulated in the last hearing, where as many as 50% of the participants in our EIP program had been given incorrect rates for the sale of their tax credits. As we find issues, we're consistently correcting them and making sure that they conform to rule in our process. So I would like to say that everyone is on firm ground. I think we are at this point, but there is a pretty well documented history of inconsistent management in that program that we continue to try and address.
Thank you.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either of you, as you're walking through these positions, are these positions for which you have budgetary authority, whether they're filled or unfilled, or are these positions that you're walking through actually, like, you have somebody slotted for that? And also, could you speak to if this is only people that you have or positions that you have filled currently, are there unfilled vacancies that are sitting there in your budgets that for which you could add people, but they're just unfilled right now?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Edwards, overwhelmingly these are positions that are full or currently filled. Our internal audit position is currently unfilled, as that particular position was actually just recently promoted in the agency. There are positions throughout the agency that are not filled right now. We, in an effort, given the budget constraints that we've sort of been living under for the last couple of years, we are very careful about filling positions and go through a pretty significant evaluation period to determine whether or not we actually need them. We are getting closer to fully staffed, but as we enter this next budget cycle, we are looking at a handful of other positions that we likely will eliminate going into the next biennium.
So for follow-up. So for clarification purposes, and it wasn't this position in particular that drove this question, because I actually didn't know that it applied to this particular position. But so as we look at these positions, whether it's, you know, that one or, you know, three human resource personnel, I mean, what I'm wondering is, are there other – so you show 3.0 FTE for human resources, okay? Are there two more unfilled vacancies that are actually – but you're just showing us what you're actually operating at currently? Or, and that's what I'm wondering, is really how many are, what are we not seeing that you guys should be doing?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Edwards, I don't believe we have hit a circumstance yet, with the exception of internal audit, in which we're showing less than what we have and what we're budgeted for. Obviously, we would have to run through that very quickly post-hearing to make sure that that's accurate. But I think just offhand that internal audit is the only one that's currently unfilled that we've shown on the screen, or the only one that we have budget authority that isn't filled currently.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mike, before you go on, I think previously you mentioned you had some DAS required audits that the agency also does. Are those internal audits to the agency or to DAS?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, they are internal. Best example is, for example, the credit cards that agencies use that are assigned for purchases. Spots cards are an annual audit that have to be conducted. They're sort of on the smaller scale of administrative issues that we have to regularly check and are directed by DAS. So sort of on the lower end of risk, but regularly looked at by the agencies.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Senator Edwards, to clarify Mr. Kaplan's words, these are actually budgeted FTE Moving back to budget, I have one vacancy in budget right now. That is because when we had vacancies in the other agent, other divisions, using the indirect model, when those are vacant, we don't get the money to cover central services. So that's been held vacant for a while to save money. But now that we're fully staffed again, we'll probably have to hire that position. Moving on, and we have a government relations employee who you're all very well aware of. That position provides agency staff with training on policy development and keeps our legislative legislation moving through the system, and is very busy during legislative session, obviously. And finally, the administrative services includes three FTE in communications. This has been a significant focus for improvement for the agency. We are in the midst of a website redesign. We started a monthly newsletter. We have improved internal communications. We've worked on our social media presence, and we've also started a blog. One of our biggest gaps we identified at the department was our communications gap. Stakeholders indicated they did not know what we were doing, and that impacted trust in our agency. Rebuilding trust will take a very long time, but we are working diligently to get the word out about our work, and it's important to all Oregonians. I'd like to hand it back off to Director Kaplan.
One of the themes you've heard us repeat consistently is our current struggle with data and the underlying technology that supports it. This is an area that the agency has under-resourced for years and has created significant and recurrent problems. Capturing data, identifying trends, accurately tracking the impact of our work, informing the public and the legislature should be the bedrock of a department that works on the issues that we do. Over the past 2 years, we've spent time and resources evaluating and trying to fix problems with our information technology. These problems are years in the making, and we believe will take significant investment in the future to fix. The IT section supports the entire agency. It has a staff of six FTE, full-time FTE, and two part-time positions. The department does not have one seamless data management program. In fact, we have 33 different program and user applications in addition to 14 infrastructure programs. In plain English, our IT team supports databases and applications that are essentially cobbled together one-offs. For example, we have a RETSI database, a Betsy database, a SELP database, an ARA database, a SHO database, and so on and so forth. Beyond that, our IT team also supports every other application you'd expect from an agency of our size, such as network administration, desktop support, phones, email, disaster recovery, and more.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Mr. Kaplan, you mentioned that you had all these RETSI and Betsy and all these different. Why would you not have an individual database for RETSI?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, all of our programs ideally should be saving energy or tracking the production of energy. As all of these tax credit programs are in different databases, it means, and we'll get into this in a little bit more detail, it means that we're asking even minutely different questions or tracking data in different ways, which means that when we want to combine that data, when we want to tell a story, when we want to communicate the effectiveness of our programs, that data requires manual manipulation. It requires people to go in, smooth that data, take it out of one database, put it into another database. There's lots of touching by people, which is both time intensive and leads to mistakes. Having one centralized database in which we can put all of the impacts of our programs leads to more reliable data that can be more efficiently gathered and more conveniently communicated. So even though the programs do different things, the data that we collect from them should be able to talk to one another. And in it not being able to do so has led to a lot of unreliable data. Problems that we talked about some at the last hearing where it's increasingly hard or very hard to talk about the impact of those programs from an energy perspective because that data is in so many different places.
Follow up.
How could you accurately track one individual aspect that you're dealing with Betsy, Retsy, whatever it may be, how can you accurately track it when you dump it into a major overall database that wouldn't correspond to that one little thing? You're taking the data from here and putting it into a big thing. How do you get it back when you need to know just what Retsy's doing?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, the database technology that exists now is so much more sophisticated than it used to be, and is largely a measure of the effort that's put into entering data. So the better that the data quality is that's going in, the easier it is to extract in a variety of different perspectives to answer a variety of different questions. We should be able to very easily pull that data apart, and we know the technology exists to do that right now, and has for a long time. We're not talking about a next step in database management or data management. We're actually talking about industry standard application that the agency should have had access to years ago. You know, being able to pull it apart and look at it from different perspectives or from a certain program will and should be easier as we get more sophisticated, or if we get more sophisticated data management tools.
Thank you.
Prior to 2005, the agency had delayed needed upgrades to physical hardware applications and IT tools as a way to control costs. That continued choice over time impacted nearly every employee and their work at the department. For example, large data sets, precisely the kind that many of our staff need to access their work, would routinely crash aging computers. We often ran programs that had little available support from vendors, if any, rendering them unreliable. Additionally, the agency had a near total lack of governance, meaning almost no business oversight or prioritization of IT efforts at the agency. We've also had previous IT managers that lacked experience in education and information technology and subsequently were unable to strategically plan for the agency's IT needs going into the future. Appropriate IT solutions, let alone modern ones, were not being routinely utilized.
Mike, if you had any, communications or help from the CIO, Alex Pettit?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, informally, we've contacted, obviously, we have a close relationship with DAS. We did, and we're about to get into this, we did bring in a third-party vendor to help us with an evaluation of our data systems, which I'll articulate in just a moment. Going back just slightly to, and not to be repetitive to Senator Olson's question from just a few minutes ago, prior to 2015, we had no common language between our databases, and therefore information that we collected had different definitions for different programs. This means that our data did not fit cohesively together. We hadn't been asking the same question or agreeing on the same language amongst most of our programs. To get our data to sync, we had to manipulate it manually, and that has led to errors, required assumptions, and meant that the one thing we should strive to be replicable and unassailable is anything but. Additionally, the tools we have used are either antiquated or burdened beyond their capacity. For example, we've been using Fox Pro throughout the agency, which is a database management tool that has not been supported by its vendor since 2004. We have also used Excel as our primary tool, primary data tracking tool in a variety of programs. Obviously, the results of poor IT management.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Just quickly, Mike, prior to 2015, did the agency have 6.5 FTE in IT?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, I believe it did, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. Thank you for Senator Whitsitt for stopping the program a little bit. As you know, I recently asked for the educational backgrounds of everyone, and I have a list of staff directory. And the people on the staff directory that I didn't ask for were the IT people. Are those same IT people still in place?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, I would guess so, but I don't know what staff directory you're looking at, but we could certainly get you that information.
I'm looking at the staff directory that you have published and that I just pulled off the internet about 2 weeks ago, so it must not have changed.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, that would be current. That's correct.
Is Jake Rosenbaum your IT manager?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, yes.
Okay, was he in place when prior to 2015?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, no, he was not.
Thank you.
Obviously, the results of poor IT management and data constraints are relatively self-evident, but specifically, our staff was spread too thin, just keeping programs moving, not planning for the future. We had limited support of most of our tools, and we lacked effective controls when we were entering and managing data. Our analysis of the severity of the problems led us to a conclusion that an outside perspective would be helpful, so we contracted with a third party to review the agency's data systems.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mr. Kaplan, why did you go to a third party instead of the CIO? Did it ask?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, the request for the third-party analysis was actually included in the 2013-2015 budget request. The resources were there. We had asked for approval from the legislature to go that route and decided to utilize that, the resources gained from that POP.
Good answer.
I don't think anybody goes to DAS unless DAS grabs them.
Did what the legislature said, evidently. Co-chair Byer.
They can.
I'm making an assumption. I want to check if it's correct that apparently that request was approved by Alex Petty, our CIO.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Byer, I believe the request for that analysis preceded the CIO at DAS, Mr. Pettit.
Has he looked at it since?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I am not sure if it's been elevated to that level, but I highly doubt it.
Wow. Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
The question being then, since we did hire a new person who is extremely proficient in IT, and he is our head guy for the state, why didn't you go to him rather than spend money on a third-party outside assessment? We've done these outside assessments and haven't had great success with them.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, the work on this report largely preceded a lot of the work that was done in the DAS CIO's office and the standing up of the expertise in that office post, obviously, all of the IT concerns that have been raised in the state. So we were working on that sort of concurrently. And just getting to present it now, this work has been in the can for a significant amount of time. So this analysis largely happened while all of that work at DAS was also happening. So this was the option that we had funding for and pursued at the time.
Follow up.
How much is the funding?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I believe the request was for $150,000, but we came in under budget. The exact price of the work, we could certainly follow up with the committee and provide.
Thank you.
The report from that assessment, I believe, has been provided to the committee. In a nutshell, the work analyzed how we gather, aggregate, and analyze energy data. The firm, Dalaris, provided ODO with data and process documentation and several paths forward, including both short and longer term solutions for the future. We recognize that this report is just a snapshot and may have information that is not entirely comprehensive due to its relatively specific scope and duration. However, the report provided the agency with a necessary starting point. The risks that Dalaris quickly identified included many that we have spoken to in previous hearings. As I've mentioned, our data management is decentralized. Programs record data in distinctly different places, relying on reporting processes to combine data across programs. The design of these systems are standalone entities and means that systems don't fit together succinctly for reporting or portfolio management. Extensive staff time is required to combine this data. We also have trouble locating data. Internal historical data require locating program staff responsible for the data in question, often resulting in references to shadow systems, i.e., staff spreadsheets, stashed spreadsheets or documents, which are inaccessible to peers to provide answers. While similar problems exist and persist throughout business and government, Dalaris feels that ODO is an extreme case. High levels of staff specialization are also a problem. Key staff do not have redundant skills to compensate for our limited technology. Data standards also aren't enforced at entry. Inconsistently implemented data and lack of data entry checks with almost no automated data quality control. Finally, we have inconsistent data quality. There was no organization-wide data policies that had been in place, and programs don't operate on consistent definitions of data. The recommendations that were made from this analysis were not revolutionary. There should have become agency practice years ago. Nevertheless, those recommendations included creating one centralized data system to use database technology that is industry standard and supported by vendors, and have a system that can be accessed by other systems and our partners, and among other services, be able to use external resources to validate the data that we collect. The benefits of these recommendations would make us more valuable to stakeholders, more convenient to program participants, and make our data more reliable. They would allow us to reduce risk and increase performance and, ideally, implemented, lower costs and increase efficiency over time. Currently, to bring all of our data together, we have staff pull out of data out of multiple databases, smooth it, and bring it back together. Inherently, and I spoke again, this is a little repetitive, such a process introduces bias and creates risk where there doesn't have to be any. A data warehouse that stores all of our data improves quality, value, and reliability. Additionally, it is a reasonable goal to have data that we can share directly with our stakeholders, citizens, the legislature, and other audiences. More information, more easily available and accessible, will only lead to a more informed discussion of energy policy. Some of our manual reporting processes takes months. Automation can reduce that to days or hours. Dolores's recommendations are relatively expensive, and many of the decisions about the future of the Department of Energy will deeply influence if and at what level we should implement those improvements. So given that our tax credit programs are scheduled to sunset, we will not be moving forward with a centralized application system for the time being. We are also unable to fund a comprehensive data warehouse solution currently. However, we are likely to request the budget authority to invest in a customer relationship management system. One of the key focus points over the last 2 years has been to have our divisions break down their silos and work more closely together. We believe that it is important, given that there are many different ways to communicate with the Department of Energy and access its programs, that tracking how we engage with customers and in what ways is an idea well past its time at Department of Energy.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
One of the recommendations, Mr. Kaplan, was to increase staff. Is there for increasing IT staff, is that still on the table? And if that is on the table, what would be the ongoing cost of that? And also, it would be, I know you're a little bit in limbo as to what recommendations you would try to implement, but it would be really useful to this committee, I believe, to have an estimate of hardware costs, the software costs, and then the ongoing staff costs to run it, and not least, how would that affect your charges from DAS for the government service charges, which would that reduce them or increase them or whatever? And I don't expect you to have that on the top of your head.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, it's very much a chicken or egg question. What is the department going to look like will drive very much what the IT solutions or recommendations look like. There are a variety of recommendations in the Dolores report. Some are, in my estimation, beyond something that we could reasonably afford or implement in one fell swoop. So I think it will be a negotiation between what we can reasonably afford and justify and run efficiently over time. Obviously, the budget issues at the department are a prevailing concern. So we have to balance the two as far as exact numbers. If we know what the department's going to look like and what our expectations and programs will look like in the future, that will make that question much, much easier. We could certainly look at, if we were the same as we were today in 2 years, what implementing some of these solutions would look like, but that may give a sort of misleading answer given that so much is dynamic about our future right now.
You follow up with me.
Follow up.
I appreciate that you're in limbo, but from the standpoint of a decision on what to do with the agency and what direction the agency should take, we really should have some idea of the cost. I mean, this obviously is a smaller project than OHA, for instance, but that's $120 million or whatever. The DMV was $150 million, or, I mean, it's I'm taking this off the top of my head, but I mean, are we talking something that we could, the legislature could provide the funding to create a reasonable and useful IT setup for within say $5 million or $10 million or whatever, I mean, in that ballpark, because I think it's something we need to know.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, we're well below $5 million at the very minimum. Even if we went with all of Dolaris's recommendations, it's much less than that, given that we're a much smaller department. So I think the most expensive recommendation in Dolaris, and again, we didn't have the opportunity to sort of provide the the natural give and take that state agencies have to go through as they're sort of putting together policy option packages, I believe was around $2 million.
So when PERS was doing their IT, they were doing it in-house with a third party, and then they ran it by Mr. Pettit, and that the price tag more than doubled. So, I mean, I would really recommend that you also get Mr. Pettit involved, because when you get into that stage gate deal, it's a little more expensive to get it done, but then it works.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, depending on the kind of investment that's made, whether or not that triggers the stage gate, one way or another, we'll be engaging in DAS in the future. But again, a lot of it's driven by what does the department look like, and what are its programs, and what are its IT needs at that point. But we view DAS as a significant resource going forward. So now I've presented a number of the challenges and problems that Dolaris and our own team has identified. However, we've also, where available, implemented a number of solutions. What we focused on are those no or low-cost opportunities for improvement. I won't read all of them, but in terms of the most important, we have implemented data governance within the agency and a data governance team, which is currently making policy in terms of the kinds of information and the kinds of questions that we ask and collect. We also have IT security governance, which has been implemented and a plan approved and has started meeting. We have data quality assurance being addressed regularly, working on implementing tools and processes to ensure that our data is clean going into our systems. We have also incorporated geographic information systems, GIS, which help many of our programs, most specifically siting currently. We've also introduced modern data reporting and analysis tools. We have migrated out of many outdated databases and are moving to modern systems. So, for example, moving out of Fox Pro, which is no longer supported, to SQL and a variety of programs. We've also externally published many of our data sets, which has improved transparency and offered opportunities for stakeholders to engage in our programs.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, I guess I have a concern. You've said that the data that you have, you don't have any confidence in for various reasons. I'm a little concerned as if you're creating a new system and loading that past tainted information into the system, that it'll not be helpful on. I'm wondering if maybe you ought to consider a bright line.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, what we are doing now is taking the data that we do have and making it more accessible and manageable. If and when we are able to have the comprehensive data management system that we hope for, we will absolutely have to draw a bright line and create a date and time in which we're not relying on that past data. That is a big question about how we move forward currently. So I couldn't agree with you more. You're absolutely right. Mm. Uh, Other improvements that we've made to IT is we have replaced our aging fleet of computers. We are training our IT staff to be more redundant so that they can provide backup for one another. And we are continuing to explore low-cost opportunities for improvement moving into the future.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you. So I hate to let you leave that last part, Director, without asking this question. It's been suggested by our governor that the department's future might include making sure that we meet our carbon reduction goals. So my question would be, does this system that you have here lend itself to that type of a goal, and if so, how?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Bentz, I don't currently think that we have the resources in place to accurately track that type of data, nor have we been asking that question reliably over time. As those responsibilities are, or if that direction is given to the department, this IT solution, these IT improvements would be necessary to meet that responsibility. I think that they go part and parcel with our future.
Follow up.
Okay, so what I'm really getting at here is if we were going to direct this department that way, how much more would you need to make this program fit that kind of desired outcome? Do we have a clue? That's my real question. Do we know?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Bentz, the work that we have done to date includes analysis of what we would need to appropriately run the programs that we have. We would obviously, given new programs or new responsibilities, would have to address that to make sure that they were appropriate for whatever new thing that we were being asked to do.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Bentz's question, that strikes me that you wouldn't want to duplicate the system that already exists at DEQ, which is where that's tracked now. And so whatever, if you're having an energy measurement, that you'd probably need to talk to the – have systems that talk to each other.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, that's exactly one of the recommendations from Dolaris, is that we have databases that can interact with other resources that are out there. So that would be that would obviously be part of the package that we would hope to be able to achieve. Moving to the future, what we want is accurate and reliable data and best practices to capture data and reporting practices that follow that. We want secure and reliable infrastructure, following standardized replacement policies that aren't subject to budgetary constraints. We would like to move more of our resources to cloud-based support, which allow for greater resiliency and better support our emergency operations. All of our IT practices should be governed from a business perspective, and we hope to achieve industry-standard IT operations. Also, we should have the staff and the resources to install relevant and progressive technology solutions and regularly replace unsupported customer applications. Whenever a vendor no longer supports a product, we shouldn't be using it anymore. Again, sort of really standard business practice that the Department of Energy should make sure to regularly adapt. So with that, that concludes remarks on IT, unless you have any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Easier said than done.
We've heard a considerable amount on the lack of IT and the ability of the IT to work prior to a turnover to this new system or to a new system. What happens with all the data that you have now currently that we can't use and doesn't make heads or tails? And going over your education list, most everybody in there is new. So how do we figure out what we've lost?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, data is my biggest concern. It was what I sort of harped on at the last hearing. I do not know how to salvage that data. There are 35 years of Betsy history that's there. There's 30 years of SELP history. I'm sure a lot of it is usable. But I don't know how to make it whole. I don't know how to fix it. I'm not sure that it can be uniformly fixed, given that a lot of the work and a lot of, you know, the businesses that have received those tax credits and have garnered resources from them don't exist anymore. The questions that we asked of RETSI recipients 30 years ago are very different than the kind of data that we collect now. So I don't have an answer to that. I don't have a good answer to that question, unfortunately.
Yeah, follow up?
Follow up.
So where is it going to sit? Where is it going to go? Where is this information going to go? Is it just going to sit in these obsolete computers off to the side? Or?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, we would have to make a decision about how we captured and stored that data over time. That would certainly be part of any plan to move forward. We would have to figure that out.
Follow-up. Since there are subpoenas out for some of this information, will some of this information be brought forward through these subpoenas?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, there are a variety of work that's being done to explore a lot of the Department of Energy. We have been all of our records have been preserved for the last couple of years. So anything that anyone wants access to is available right now. The point that I'm sort of bringing up today is our ability to use it for policymaking as opposed to its mere existence. All of the data is there. But as we get into issues of return on investment or energy saved or energy produced, those types of things, from an aggregate standpoint is where I start to worry about its integrity, not on the individual level, which would be subject to or interest of any sort of investigation that may be going on right now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. To follow up on Senator Olson's questions, did I hear you correctly that the records have been preserved for the last couple of years?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, we're on a records retention schedule normally, and we have all of the data that we're able to keep in our programmatic databases is kept. But there have been some significant statewide investigations, namely back to the former governor, where we have, in the interest of caution about that, preserved all of our records. We have not been deleting anything or getting rid of any of our records in being abundantly cautious about what might be needed from us in the future.
Have there been some records deleted?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, absolutely not. No.
Okay, good. Have you considered having a forensic audit done of that data to find out what it holds, what it tells us, and what it doesn't tell us?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, there is a forensic audit occurring right now on the BETSI program, specifically looking back into that data going back to 2006. But we have a forensic audit being a very specific thing, looking for. Generally speaking, looking for fraud or other impropriety is not something we've considered for the rest of the databases in the department. No, we have not considered that.
So one follow-up then. We're assuming then that this is just the lack of data, the lack of your trust in the data is just serendipity, that it wasn't anything purposeful, it was just bad management?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, I think it's a combination of things which I've articulated. I think it's poor investment in IT infrastructure. I think it's the lack of IT governance in terms of evaluating the data that's going into systems. I think it's that contributing factors that programs have changed over time. So again, questions that we would have asked 15 years ago are very different than questions we would have asked yesterday about some of these things. So as that changes, that changes the quality of the data. The fact that they're in separate spaces and different questions are asked. For example, RETSI has had hundreds of thousands of recipients. If you ask, if you don't uniformly implement the zip code that those RETSIs were received in, then combining it, for example, with BETSI data and saying where have all the tax credit gone, but the zip codes are different. A very minor sort of data control mechanisms like that can lead to wildly incompatible data. So all of those things over time add up to a system which to my thinking, is not as sophisticated and does not provide the level of reliability that we would ask for. And that's only on a very simple thing. If we get into other issues more complex, in terms of energy saved or energy produced, it gets harder and harder over time. So that fundamentally leads to my lack of confidence in what the data looks like overall.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you may have answered this, and forgive me for asking it again. The question is the department capable of moving forward without direction from this committee? Is that what you are now doing necessary because of the ongoing review, or because this is what you think the department should be doing as it kind of waits in this hiatus between now and the 17th session? I guess what I'm wanting to hear is, why are you doing anything as opposed to waiting for us to say what it is we think this department should do?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Benz, I have to do and manage this agency as best I can at every day. There are so many dynamic features influencing it that I don't think that we can afford to wait for another year to take action. IT, the governance, and that's exactly why we focused on no or low-cost solutions. We are not expending tremendous resources to fix things that should be bedrock principles of any state government agency. So having an IT data governance team, for example, and having data entry direction is a very low-cost thing, which will lead to good data. Obviously, we're not investing huge dollars in fixing things, given that we don't know what the future of the department is. So we're doing what we can, flagging problems when we can and where we can, while we also wait for our future to be determined. So we're working on several different tracks as best as we possibly can right now.
Yeah. Follow up. Yeah, that's a good answer, and that's what I was hoping to hear, so thank you.
So Mike, I would assume that the agency is still moving forward with their statutory duties and doing those the best that you can, and when you see that you need to do something differently, or how you're getting it done is something that's in your control, and you move forward and trying to do it the best the agency can.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I feel that in terms of how we do business and ensuring that we do it the best we can is absolutely our responsibility right now. The policy calls that this committee wants to recommend to the legislature, and the legislature ultimately wants to make, those will certainly influence what our path forward is. But in terms of the work that we do now, working every day to do it as best as we possibly can feels a totally reasonable responsibility, and one that we try and meet eagerly. So that's been our focus.
Yeah, I guess to my point is that how you get that done is a call that your agency sort of makes, given the direction that the legislature has given you in the past.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct.
Thanks. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Mr. Kaplan, I want to thank you to start with for answering my requests on educational backgrounds. I really appreciated that. A little disappointed in the lack of specifics as far as who is in that position and what they do. I had to kind of try to ferret that out, and I don't know why that was. It should be pretty easy to put down a name and say, this guy does this job. But thank you anyhow. The question I have for you, though, is I've noticed in going through these files, most everyone is new from what I've seen. And a lot of it doesn't correlate with the list that is on your website as to your staff directory. So I was just concerned about that. But my question on the newness, what does that do to carry forward the continuity, since we have so many new people that have started in the last few years, to move the continuity forward from where you were to what you're doing now?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, the Department of Energy over the last 10 years has been a very difficult place to work. It has exhausted many of our employees, many former directors. It is not easy to be there every day. So I think that we have had a significant amount of turnover, which has settled over the last 2 years or so. As far as the newness, people don't necessarily make careers in state government anymore at single agencies that last for for a very long period of time. There's a lot of moving around. So I think all of those contributing factors certainly led to the kind of turnover that we've had. I would like to think that we've stabilized into the future so that the continuity that we're building now, the improvements that we're building now, the culture that we're changing will hold and be adapted over time into the future of the agency, whatever that future looks like. But it is certainly when you have five directors over 6 years, when you have the kinds of challenges that have faced the department, that's certainly a hard thing to come to work at every day.
Follow up. I am impressed with some of the hires you have in there. There's some very astute folks with some really good degrees. But the question is, goes back to the past experience with the information that we have that we're going to lose. It concerns me that we have this robust IT program that doesn't work, and we're going to get rid of all the information or lose the information, which is the foundation for your department. You have to know what you did in the past to see what you're going to do in the future, and it seems, looks to me like you're starting all over with a whole brand new program, which concerns me.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, I don't think our program is robust at all. I think it's cobbled together over time. It was poorly implemented and poorly managed and poorly monitored. So what we had been was not sufficient and did not meet the responsibilities that it should have. The only thing I can do is sort of work on how do we fix it moving forward. I cannot, as of right now, figure out a path to make that to fix all of the past mistakes. We can certainly try and take on as many as possible, but the lack of reliability in the data that's been collected over 40 years is something that I would certainly look for guidance on how to save it. But I don't necessarily know how to do that myself or my team, for that matter, at this point, to make up for that level of history.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Question as it relates to the data. So tell me if I'm understanding this correctly. Your fear is taking bad data and putting bad data into new data creates more bad data. So when you had the evaluation done, did they give you a sense of what you do with the bad data that you do have so that you don't corrupt the new or skew the new good data that you're trying to accumulate over the last few years? Is there a way that they can archive that without jeopardizing or affecting the new system that you're putting in place?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Hack, we can partition it. That's not the issue. We can always have it. It's not as if the point is to throw it out. What we can't do, or likely will be unable to do, is to use that data as we collect new data and combine them. So in other words, if we wanted to go with and this is presuming we get a comprehensive data management system and presuming that we have programs that would put data into it. But what we wouldn't be able to do is to say from that date forward with these new programs and adding up 35 years of Betsy that we know comprehensively what the return on the state's investment is. That's where I think that there's a significant problem is making the old not necessarily comprehensive data work with whatever new that we're doing in the future. But we can still have it. I question its reliability.
So just a quick follow-up. The third-party evaluator, when they came in and looked at the system and gave you the recommendations, what is their recommendation on how you either house that data or what you do with it moving forward? I mean, I know you're saying you don't understand, you're not sure how to do it and you don't agree with the integrity of it, but it's really all we have. So what was their recommendation?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Hack, I think they recognize the same thing that Senator Beyer did and I do, is that you can keep that data, but as it's used to inform future decisions, it's simply unreliable. So we can have it, we can use it, but the question is how much do we want to rely upon it? So I think
continues to be bad until you cut it at some point. And thank you.
And I just to add, it is not as if every line is bad. It's not as if they're all corrupted. But there are a perfect example is solar panels have gotten more efficient over time, but we make assumptions on and their performance degrades over time too. More recent panels last longer. Well, if we apply an assumption to all of the solar panels that have been installed in Oregon over the last 30 years, well, we're going to be way conservative in terms of the kinds of energy that they produce. Keeping up with those market conditions and having a database which can uniformly implement sort of changes and variance is something that we don't have the opportunity to do right now. So we can wildly underreport in some cases. We might be wildly overreporting in other cases. So it's a pretty, and given how dynamic energy is as a field and as an industry and how quickly it's evolving, that all calls into question the data that we've collected over time.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on that, I mean, that's a problem that even with the best new sparkly computer system, you're always going to have that problem because you've always got data from the past based on assumptions that will change as technology changes. So I think you're always going to have some of that. Yeah, it's just the nature of the beast. The other one is that I think the stuff you have already, if you move to a new system, you're right, you're required by law to archive that for a certain number of years. Your problem's going to be is if you have it in, convert it to some kind of hard copy format or keep it in software, at least a couple of the programs that you're using, you're going to be able to use those for quite a while, although as the systems change, like we all know they change like weekly, you get to update your system thing. There's at some point you may not be able to get to the data if it's in that kind of shape. Although assuming that we have as good a IT department at DAS and elsewhere, you probably can find a solution to that. Although the quality and the value of the information and for policy is probably not that great on a going forward basis.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, I think that there are, as far as I've been informed, there are more sophisticated tools. There are other agencies using more sophisticated resources to track their impact. Will we be able to solve the inherent problems with collecting data for all time? Certainly not. But I do think that we can do a better job in terms of the quality of the data going in, the kinds of questions that we ask, the uniformity of those questions being asked. I think that there are some really simple things that we can do once we have the resources to support those efforts.
You can have that problem. And inherent in moving to a cloud-based system is that you're going to have that changes, systematic changes that are occurring on an ongoing basis. So you're going to have – that's one of the downsides of going to that kind of a system is – you're at the mercy of the manager of that system, developers and managers of that, as opposed to an internal proprietary system.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, there are no foregone conclusions about what a system would look like or if we'll have a system. All of that sort of remains to be seen. I think this is more of a philosophical issue. The attractiveness of a cloud-based system for some of our programs, if not all of them, are in terms of the resiliency work that we do and the emergency preparedness is that with so much riding on a server room, if we had one of those really bad days, would certainly not be helpful when we could move to something more reliable in the cloud. So it's a variety of sort of a global IT question that has individual components that we're discussing.
You're not alone in dealing with this.
Yeah, right.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. A lot of talk on data, a lot of talk about it, what you have and what doesn't work and et cetera. When you put together a Betsy program, or when you used to put together a Betsy program or a RETSI program or any program, what data do you collect? Do you send it out to the person and say, this is what I need to know from you, and then you put this into a file and you have that on file?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, I haven't had the pleasure of putting together a tax credit program. I've only had to clean them up.
Okay.
the data that's asked for has changed over time. There's a lot that you can tell automatically from a RETSI, for example, a RETSI application, the installation of a new energy-efficient ductless heat pump, for example. You're going to know right off the bat when you have that application the features of that heat pump, you know, the location of the recipient, where it's installed, that kind of thing is going to come in with the application. For some of our bigger projects, I don't think the tax credit programs were thoughtful enough about requiring performance agreements and reporting of performance data over time. I think that if I had an opportunity to design a tax credit program or an incentive program, that would be part and parcel with what you'd want, so that you would not necessarily be making assumptions on the front end that would carry you through the life of the program, but you would get live reporting about performance. It really depends on the size of the program, the size of the incentive, the types of questions that are being asked, and also the kind of information that you want to collect. 35 years ago, I'm not sure that RETC staff thought, well, we should try and figure out what the greenhouse gas reduction is of RETCs. That might be a question that we would want to ask of a residential incentive program if there were one going into the future, and how to capture that data and how to model it. I think would be the kinds of questions, given that we have a more complete understanding of the impact that we want to have, would certainly be helpful as we talk about ROI and what these programs do.
Right, follow up. Because you talked about zip codes. If the zip code was input incorrectly, it screws the database up. What benefit is an accurate zip code, other than to know how many central heating units you put into an area?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, that's just the most accessible anecdote I have. But location data is incredibly important as we're trying to tell the legislature and our stakeholders the impact that the Department of Energy has had. Being able to show you where every RETC was in the state would be a huge value, I think. I think that would speak very much to the kind of work that the Department of Energy has done and the scope. We're actually, as we implement GIS, we're actually not very far away from being able to do at least that, to the extent that the address data is reliable. I think that the geographic reach of our department, we've hit every, during the last hearing, we showed that there were Betsy's in every county, for example. Being able to geolocate where things are happening and the kinds of uptake on our programs, I think, is a real tool to start talking about value and impact.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I think it maybe should be noted, as I'm listening to all this these issues about data, certainly there's a lot of data that's probably not useful to us or isn't reliable because it doesn't look at the same parameters that we'd look at today. But I would also assume in that discussion that there is data that in the future could be gleaned from that old data where we did find it to be reliable that could tell us something. We just don't know what that question might be right now. But
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I think the pressure I feel is for the department to provide reliable information that can be checked and replicated, and to the extent that I have confidence in that data, I'm happy to share it. To the extent that I don't have confidence in the data, I want to be the first person to say that. I am not suggesting that there's a future in which we just totally forgo and dump everything that we have and act like it never happened. We never know what we'll want to go back and look at and glean. I am just saying that as we produce reports and as the legislature is asking us for our, you know, the amount of energy that's been saved over the last 40 years because of the Department of Energy's RETC program, we can get you a number. I am reluctant to bet my life on that number, for example, and I think we should get to a point in which we have data that's more reliable. I don't think that's an outlandish goal for us. It seems like a place that we should land and work toward finding as quickly as possible.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, we've obviously had a lot of discussion about the importance of data, or data, depending on your preference. And you have expressed a lot of concern about the lack of reliability in that information. But I'm just as interested in your perspective on how we got here. Because, I mean, if we fast forward 10 years, 20 years, we could be in a similar hearing, and I have no idea what the technology will look like at that time, what the department will be measuring, but I'm positive that we could probably sit through similar hearings at that point and look back at the previous decade or two and look at, you know, what you know, what it's created up to that point and how irrelevant it seems at that point in the future. So what is it, what has allowed us to get here from your perspective in terms of either, you know, how the agency is structured, how it's managed? It is a fairly overhead intensive agency, as we've been going through the number of, you know, budget people, the number of HR people, the number of this and that. So in those operations, like, what, I mean, how did we get here from your perspective? How did we end up with legacy after legacy after legacy, system after system, that now feels somewhat, I won't say irrelevant, but it's lacking from your perspective?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Edwards, I think that the Department of Energy got very big, very fast, beyond its capability. When Betsy was accelerated, when SELP was accelerated, it exceeded the resources of the agency, and in doing so, they did not, or the agency did not adapt as quickly as it should have. Now, I think in terms of the my biggest sort of criticism of the agency as I look back, I don't think they ask the question regularly of what do we do if something goes wrong? How do we protect ourselves? How do we ensure that we are able to describe, for example, the impact of our programs? Well, the natural answer to that is, well, we should have unassailable, really good data so at least we can show what it's done. I'm not sure that those questions were asked reliably. I think that the sophistication of the agency at the time, when it went from essentially a 70-person shop to a 140-person shop within 2 years, put a lot of pressure on the administration of the agency, and that led to trying to adapt as quickly as possible. And so in doing so, you have systems that you create that are meant to be implemented easily and efficiently, but are not necessarily the best for the long-term outlook of the agency. I also think there's consistent fiscal pressure. It is very hard to justify expenses and resources in state government. That's a difficult process. And IT is one of those areas that sometimes gets short shrift because there are ways that you can manage your way around problems. For example, creating an Excel database. We use Excel to track our loan portfolio. You know, with Excel, if you have a keying error of a zero on the revenue you expect for a loan, which we've had, you could wildly overstate the amount of revenue you expect. Sophisticated loan management software won't allow that kind of mistake. So I think it's a combination of things that happen to the agency and over time. And I hope that we're not here in 10 years. I guarantee I won't be here to repeat this conversation in 10 years. But if anything, that I think it's really important to ask agencies as they come in with new initiatives, how are they planning to deal with, how are you going to anticipate if things go south or if this program accelerates beyond your control, if that possibility is there, how are they thinking about that in the future, I think are valuable questions.
Go to your buyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't miss this. I think, Mike, I think you're taking a lot of this on the department from yourself, and to get at Senator Edwards' question, I think a lot of the problem that the department has had is a lack of clear design of program by the legislature and lack of clear direction as to what was expected. Agencies do a pretty good job of responding to directive, clear directives from the legislature, but just the nature of legislating is legislatures are not very good at getting into the details, and I think the euphoria of 2006-2007 around renewables and all of that created a heck of a problem for the department. In fact, as we talked about before, a few of your large loan problems were actually programs that were directed by a governor or the legislature. Over the objection of the department. So we're as much to not this current panel, but some of those who were around before, which happened during my hiatus, by the way, were as much our fault as yours, as the staff's fault.
Chair Holvey.
Who are you pointing to on this committee?
I don't think there's anybody on this panel who was around then.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, I appreciate there's a period at the end of that and not a question. Thank you.
Continue, please.
So the final section of our presentation is on the energy supplier assessment. What had been on screen is the statutory reference, which I won't bother reading here, but the energy supplier assessment, better known as the ESA. On screen, you'll notice two charts. The donut shows the breakdown of how ESA is assessed by ratepayer type. The majority come from the state's IOUs, followed by our consumer-owned utilities, independent power producers, propane concluding at about just over 2%. Also on the screen is the ESA timeline. ODO first determines all of the other available revenue needed to operate the department before it concludes the amount of ESA it will need. Energy suppliers report gross operating revenue to ODO. The assessment is then distributed proportionately based on the share of the revenue attributed to payers, and I'll give you an example in just a moment. The assessment is compared to reported revenue to ensure that it doesn't exceed any caps. To determine gross operating revenue, we ask for revenue derived from the sales or service made or provided to Oregon during the calendar year. In 2015, that was just over $11 billion. Deductions are then taken, which include motor vehicle or aircraft fuel or revenue from inter-utility sales, about $5.4 billion last year. Subtracting those deductions leaves us with eligible gross operating revenue that is subject to the assessment of $5.668 billion. Again, each supplier's assessment is directly correlated to their share of the total revenue. Here is the math on a hypothetical scenario. The gross operating revenue is $20 million minus deductions of $3 million, which leaves $17 million subject to the assessment. The eligible revenue is then divided by the total reported gross operating revenue, giving ODO the share the payer owns of that total reported gross operating revenue. That same share is then applied to the total amount of revenue that the department anticipates needing. In this case, out of $17 million of reported revenue, the assessment is just over $19,000. You've seen this in pieces over the course of the last 6 months or so, but ESA goes to every division within ODO. It's in its largest amount for our administrative services and our policy team.
Mike, before you move on, going back to the energy supplier assessment, I know that, you know, we're speaking of, you know, the gross operating revenue of the energy suppliers, but is there a specific formula for the energy supplier assessment, which would include what types of revenues can be backed out of that calculation? Because I in speaking to you, I think briefly we. I think you did identify that there were some things that energy suppliers can back out of that calculation.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, that's correct. So the what is backed out, and I don't know if you can read it here, but by and large, it's that revenue that comes from the sale of energy between utilities and also that revenue subject to gas and aviation fuel sales. So those can be backed out of the formula.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Mr. Kaplan, the last ESA, there was a pretty substantial increase to it. And many of the utilities were upset over that. I find it quite interesting that you can lay out a budget and figure out what you want and then charge them for what it is. And particularly when the last 2 hours we've been talking about incomplete data and inability to provide data to those folks. So you're charging them for a service that you can't really return to them. And could you explain why the jump in the ESA was so large?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, if you give me two slides, I will. Sure. I will get right to that.
Hate to get ahead of you.
Okay. This slide shows the history of gross operating revenue in Oregon. The scale here is in billions. The red line shows gross operating revenue over time, and you can see the blue line of the assessment at the bottom. For this biennium, our assessment is essentially 11 cents out of every $100 of revenue. To Senator Olson's question, there was a significant increase for the 15-17 biennium, and these were due to significant mistakes and decisions made during the 13-15 budget development cycle. First, during our budget hearings in front of Ways and Means, we committed to an ESA rate well before gross operating revenue was reported. This is a mistake because there is no way to know reliably what your ESA rate should be before you know the other side of the formula. It is a ratio, so only having only providing one number leads to unreliable information.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Edwards.
If I recall, there was a lot of pressure at that point because of previous, and I can't remember what the instance was, but the former director was under a lot of political pressure to come in to Ways and Means and make that commitment. Is that not correct?
Well, it was a big reserve, too.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Edwards, the ESA pressure exists all the time. I don't know for sure. I wasn't with the agency then, but I would not be surprised.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what all the circumstances were. There was the reserve, but I remember because I was co-chair of the Ways and Means sub at that time, and I remember that commitment when the former your predecessor took over and was trying to calm the storms because the agency was under fire at that time. Came in and made that commitment, like, we are not going to raise the assessment. And at that time, I think there were a lot of stakeholders, payers of the ESA that were very appreciative of that. Legislators, I know, I heard positive feedback about that. I'm like, okay, good. Now we're going to take a break here.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator,
give us some historical perspective.
Senator Edwards, The decision to set the rate prior to the gross operating revenue being reported, I believe should not happen again. However, it is, and I'll get into a second decision that was made, which was just briefly referenced, which was spending down reserves, which allowed the agency to hold that rate. Mm-hmm. Also, a perfectly reasonable cash management perspective, I think, or a budgeting perspective. I think where the agency fell down was not communicating what the impact would be in future biennia. So whenever you hold a rate down and we spent our cash reserves from 6 months of ending balance to 4 months, I believe around $2 million, essentially we used our savings to support to pay for our mortgage. Well, you can only do that once. The following biennium, what you're doing is essentially creating a funding cliff, which is now you have to make up the amount that you're assessing plus the amount that you had used in reserves, which leads to a really significant increase. Those are all perfectly valid choices, but they have to be made with the information of you're making this choice, which is going to lead to this impact in the future, which from what I can tell was never communicated outside of the department.
And to clarify, and that funding cliff was not foreseen at that point because didn't know what the revenue was going to be.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Edwards, I think that when...
It was foreseen. It wasn't communicated to the legislature. I know that.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Edwards, I don't think it was foreseen at the time. I don't think that... I think that it should have been in retrospect. I think that question of the uniformly with ESA, because it is tied biennia to biennia, anytime you make a decision on ESA, it is going to have an impact on a future ESA assessment. So whenever we do anything, there are no ESA decisions in a vacuum. If the department didn't do it at that time, and I don't think that it did, I don't think it even thought that far in the future. I think it was solving a problem in front of it right now, mm-hmm. which is a theme, I think, as we've talked about the department over time. I think at that period of time, it did not say, what will this do to 15-17? Which is what we've been working on since then.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's a really good point. it is kind of, looking back now, hindsight's always 20/20, but it is kind of hard to understand how we didn't foresee those, or the stakeholders didn't even foresee those future ramifications to the ESA.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, state budgeting is a I don't think it's how any of us would choose to budget anything. I feel like it would have been in the department's responsibility to flag that issue. We are the ones who should know what's going to happen with our revenue going forward, or at the very least, even if we don't have specifics, to be able to say if we spend $2 million of savings, we're going to have to make that up with assessed revenue in the future. That's not a wild leap. That's pretty standard cash management that should have been anticipated. Now, whether or not it was is an entirely different question, but I don't think it was communicated if it had been.
Co-Chair Byer.
Thank you. Well, Mike, I actually remember those discussions very well. I remember Senator Edwards dealing with them and others in the discussion. So the people who operate in this building representing the various stakeholders knew exactly what was happening with the reserves. And if they didn't know what would happen in the future, shame on them. But you really have a tough problem because the control on your expenditures is the legislature and the Ways and Means Committee, and all you're applying to that, I would think, is your unknown is your forecast. Once you've got a budget, your forecast of what gross revenues are going to be out there among all the energy suppliers, and then what that number, the ratio is that derives the revenue necessary to meet your legislative budget.
Chair Holvey,
the economy is going to drive a lot of that.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Byer, there is certainly the one number, and what we have tried to focus on since I took over at the department is the one number that is consistent throughout that whole process, relatively consistent, is the amount of revenue that the department will need. The rate is dynamic and the gross operating revenue is dynamic. You're right. That depends on economic conditions. That depends on a variety of math. But when we go into a budget cycle, beyond changes that the legislature might make, POPs or reductions, whatever the case may be, we by and large know a pretty reliable number of the total ESA that will be needed because we have an idea of all the other revenue that's coming into the department, which is relatively consistent because it's fees that we charge or federal grants that we expect. So if we talk about the total revenue number, that will allow for, not to the dollar, but closer math for our ratepayers to be able to anticipate what their assessments may be. Some of them, depending on if they had a very good year, that may not be consistent throughout by the time that their assessment is issued, it may have gone up, or if they had a bad year, it may have gone significantly down. But that's the rate is not reliable because it can change based on what the gross operating revenue can be. But the revenue we need is actually a pretty consistent number over time. Yeah, it could be. I've spent 3 years on this. I'm sorry.
I guess you're saying is that you could give them a proportionate number of what a utility X's share of the total ESA should be, and then it's their own forecasting how that's going to affect their budget.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Byer, what I'm saying is that the number that we'll need stays consistent. Potentially, a ratepayer could look at what they've been assessed in the past based on their revenue and what the department has collected, and that could give them theoretically some semblance of what their assessment may be. Now, that is just an informed guess as best as we can provide based on the schedule of how budgeting works.
I mean, if you look at the past, I mean, the variables that change a lot of food, and electricity rates, when you hit the recession, the revenues plummeted. When gas prices change, you had the variable on that kind of thing there. So if you're operating on a percentage of gross revenues, you're going to have you could have wild deviations.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Byer, that's absolutely correct. You could.
It's actually outside of everybody's control.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Byer, that's correct. So I think we stalled on the second factor, which led to the big increase, which was spending down reserves. I think we've covered that. The third factor that happened was that gross operating revenue declined 12% beyond or below the models that we had. This was attributable almost entirely, or the overwhelming share is because several large petroleum companies realized that for years they had been reporting gross operating revenue that was not subject to ESA. So by the time they had backed that all out, revenue that they did not have to pay ESA on, that reduced, that had a significant impact on the overall revenue for the state. All of that meant, in summation, that we committed to an assessment that was too low. We used a one-time cash management strategy to spend down reserves to support that low rate, and then assessed even less than we expected based on the decline in the gross operating revenue. In 2013-15, the agency was able to meet all of its commitments. It held the ESA to where it committed to. It spent down those reserves as it committed to, and had made budget cuts and other efficiencies to make sure that it could operate within the allotted revenue. However, what that meant was, is when you roll into the 15-17 budget development, you have assessed here. You now have to assess up to here. And I have a chart that shows that in just a second. For the coming biennium, and as a result, I think pretty directly of that increase, we will be operating under a budget note that was passed by the legislature. We have been instructed to construct our agency request budget holding to the $13.1 million assessment that we had in 15-17. Or 15-17. So we will be rolling through with the same ESA request that we had last biennium. There will be, as every state agency is subject to, there will be inflation. We will get more expensive even if we don't grow, obviously dependent on what this committee and the legislature decides. So there will be likely costs beyond that $13.1 million in ESA that we'll be dealing with when we get to the budget.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mike, on the personal services increasing, the last line on your last slide, is that something you calculated, or is that something LFO calculated, or because that seems really low. Two steps and two COLAs are 13.5% just by themselves.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, I believe the inflation rates are calculated by DAS and communicated to us.
Okay. And then just another follow-up on this appendix, Oregon Department of Energy appendix, is listing the new hires made during the 2013-15. At least 10 of the 16 were hired out of classification, or much higher than was recommended. Is that a process it is continuing, and how do you expect to pay for it?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, that's not a process that's continuing. So we're hiring within the scope of the jobs that we have available.
So you're hiring within the HRSD policy now, as opposed to there were 10 of the 16 were hired, much higher classifications than the normal policy would have indicated.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, I will check with our HR office, but I don't think that we've hired anyone I think since I've been director outside of their classification. I'll double check that, but I don't think that we've done that.
Well, there's follow up. There's at least 10 of these that are. Here's one that's hired at a step 8 exceptional qualification, hard to fill position. Hired at a step 6 exceptional qualification, hired at step 8 exceptional qualifications, and it goes on.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, I apologize. I thought you meant positions, not steps. I misunderstanding on my part. We do have within our budget authority. We have the opportunity to pay for all of those positions. So we're often trying to recruit the very best people we can, often hiring from other state agencies. Given the expertise that's required in our field, we're hiring, generally speaking, we're hiring people with outstanding qualifications by and large. So we are frankly above first step sometimes, or step 2. We are aggressively trying
to get.
They're
all above step 2. They start at step 4 and go up to step 9. But according to this deal here, I guess my point is, if your revenue is ESA revenue is capped. Your other revenue is dropping off, and you have basically the same number of employees, and you're going to pay them a lot less. Where are you going to get the money?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, we have actually reduced staff. We reduced our staff by 6.5% into this budget cycle. We will likely have a staff reduction going into next budget cycle. So we are doing the very best we can to hold the bottom line to ensure that we have the necessary staff and not too many staff. But when we recruit, we want to make sure that we're doing the best we can to bring in the most talent. I think that in terms of an organization that is coming from where the Department of Energy is to where it wants to go, the quickest way to improve is to bring in as the best talent that we possibly can. So we have to balance those competing priorities as keeping our eye on the bottom line and being as efficient as possible while bringing in the best people we possibly can.
Representative Benz. Do you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the department is going to be rebuilt, there would be an opportunity to look at this energy supplier assessment and say, is this the correct device to fund this department? There's all kinds of problems with it. Do you have a recommendation? I mean, one might say, why aren't we charging wind farms? Why aren't we charging all sources of energy? How come we're just focusing on whatever this ends up charging? I mean, rather than my wander around on this, what's your recommendation if we came to you and said, hey, we're going to rebuild this department, where should we get the money?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Benz, I think looking at the pool of people paying into the ESA would be one of my recommendations, either potentially expanding it. I think the timing of when we request gross operating revenue and when we assess is also something that I think are and this is me guessing that our ratepayers would also benefit from giving them more certainty earlier as opposed to well into their budget cycles is another area that I would look at. So those two things I think are and the revenue decisions are the legislature's, but those would be the areas that I would focus my attention or recommend that you focus your attention on.
Follow up.
So I'm thinking that when they originally designed this system that there was some linkage between that which is department is supposed to be doing and a benefit, shall we say, flowing one direction or the other, or a reason that this particular source of revenue was selected. I would like you to focus on that for a moment and say, what's the reason that we picked this particular group of people or businesses to pay for this particular department? That part's very interesting to me.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Benz, this is revenue derived from the use of energy in Oregon by its businesses, its residents, its government agencies. Whoever is consuming energy is providing the revenue, which is then feeding the ESA. So I think in terms of that there is an equitability that's accomplished by using that revenue to charge the fee for the Oregon Department of Energy. That would be based on the statutory language for when that fee was that fee was developed. That seems to be the thinking behind it.
Right. Well, the obvious follow-up was it a penalty or a benefit? What was it when this was determined? Was it you guys are doing certain damage, the department's here to try to control it, therefore you must pay? Or was it we're going to do such a great job as the Department of Energy, we're going to have you, you're going to be screaming with joy that we're going to assess you with this money because we're going to do so well with your dollars? That's what I'm interested in knowing. I want to know what the justification is. At its heart, it's a gross receipts tax, isn't it? There's no reference to profit here, is there?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Benz, it's a fee. I think that the thinking is coming out of the energy crisis that a department focused on the conservation of energy, assuring that there are renewable energy resources, that we're not overtaxing our naturally available resources, I think are all a benefit to the state and to the people that live here. So I think that that was the thinking behind it. That was certainly the thrust of the construction of the revenue. So I don't think it was a deterrent or a policing mechanism of by any stretch.
Thank you.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mr. Kaplan, is there a definition of energy source supplier in statute? It isn't provided here. But it would certainly, following up on Representative Bent's line of questioning, The 469.421.8A says the, in addition to any other fees required by law, each energy source supplier shall pay to the Department and its share of its assessment fund. So why are some, again, is the energy source supplier defined somewhere to exclude certain suppliers, or is this by rule, or how do the wind farms and solar not get assessed?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, I think we'll have to follow up with you on exactly how that's determined, and be happy to get that information to you after the hearing.
Thank you.
Sure. On the screen, you'll see the impacts of several of the past decisions that I discussed briefly visualized. For the 2013-15 biennium, you'll see the funding gap that was created by holding the assessment low. The gray demonstrating the reserves that were used to fill that gap. And then if you go from in 13-15, sort of the dark blue to the top of the 15-17 estimate, although the line isn't drawn directly there, you'll sort of see the gap that was created and the one that we had to bridge. For the 17-19 budget, what you'll see on the screen is the ESA assessment, the $13.1 million, which parallels this biennium, as well as what state government inflation would be, although we still have some decisions to make about what our budget will look like. So that isn't actually a direct representation yet. It's just to show the impact of inflation. And we are continuing to do what we can to control costs. And looking for ways to have a more efficient budget. So with that concludes our presentation for the day, and I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Any additional questions for the department? Mike, I guess I'm still interested in following up, you know, getting to understand better though you did point out, you know, what specific items can be backed out of that gross revenue calculation, and that may shed light on the solar and the wind, perhaps, maybe not, and just understanding how that calculation is derived and what's able to be taken out of that revenue. I'm still very I want to get some real specific examples of that, if possible.
Chair Holvey, we'd be happy to follow up on that.
Thanks. Anything else for the director? Senator Olson.
This goes back to what Senator Byard talked about earlier on the legislator and the governor put their fingers in your pot. Why are you limited to $13.1 million?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, that's from a budget note that was added to our budget at the conclusion of the last legislative session.
Right. I know that. But why are you limited to $13.1 million when you anticipate a larger growth? You anticipated in your one of your charts that you needed more money, 14 point something million. So why did they limit you to 13.1, 14.2? Why did they limit you to 13.1?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, a couple of things. The growth there is not necessarily what the budget request will be. It's only what our agency would cost with the inflation that we anticipate. So we don't have that final number yet. The reason I believe that the legislature put that budget note in was in reaction to the large budget, the large ESA increase that we had for this biennium. I think it was a natural reaction to that based on some completely valid frustration with what had happened with the ESA. That is the direct cause as far as I understand.
Follow up. So are we just going to continue this hopscotch? We have in 2013-15 you had a shortfall. And it looks like 2017-19, you're going to have a shortfall again. Are we just going to continue this, or are we going to actually sit down and figure out how to make it work so that you can run and function correctly?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, the ESA had been stable for a very long period of time. And I believe in 2009-11 that through growth of the agency and it might have been even in 2007-09, growth of the agency and some, and you know, to support some of the work that we've discussed here, more programs and more staff got put onto ESA, which introduced volatility into what had been a relatively stable assessment. And we contributed to that volatility with the decisions in 13-15 by holding the rate artificially low with the use of savings. The increase that we had for this biennium ideally is meant to get us to a more sustainable place so you don't see those wild fluctuations. But, you know, there are issues like PERS costs increasing and other needs that the department may have. By and large, this is a relatively stable fee. But whenever we have new costs layered on, that will increase it. So that's always going to be a challenge, and especially a challenge now as we're looking at what you're going to do or recommend to the Department of Energy is how we fund it sustainably, I think is certainly a challenge that should be answered in the future.
One last question, if you don't mind. Since we've passed some legislation that is going to definitely drive up energy costs for consumers, how will that affect your income?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, what happens to the gross operating revenue overall actually does not impact us because the revenue request we have is stable. So whether there's $20 billion a year in gross operating revenue or 10, the amount that we're going to need to run the department is the same. Where a spike in gross operating revenue will impact is the payers, in that they should see if it's uniform increase across the board, as gross operating revenue increases overall, individual shares will decrease. So you'd actually see a decrease in everyone's proportional share related to the total amount of gross operating revenue that they earned.
Assuming that you stay at the $13.1 million.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Olson, well, it's proportional. So the increase in the gross operating, if we stayed at 13.1, obviously the proportional decrease will be larger if they earn more money, but it could be if the ESA went up, that an increase could go up so much that it would also still be a proportional share of gross operating revenue could be a decrease as well, if that makes sense.
Director Kaplan, I share a little bit of Senator Olson's concern there with, you know, because on the chart it does look like, you know, you're forecasting this assessment gap, again, which would put us back in the situation of, in the future, of having to address that gap somehow or take revenues away from your department, which would cut your expenses somehow, whether it's staff or whatever. So, anyway, just highlighting that I do share Senator Olson's concern about what the implications of that fixed $13.1 million going forward.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, we flagged that concern for our Ways and Means sub too. So we, in interest of anticipating what the future looks like, we very much flagged that as an issue. So we know that could create an artificial revenue issue depending on what the decisions are of the governor. And again, this cap is only related to our agency request budget. The governor gets to decide what she wants to do, and then the legislature obviously are our budget writers, and they get to decide with how they want to handle it. But any artificial cap that creates a need for other revenue is obviously going to have an impact on future biennia.
Thank you. Senator Whitsett.
Thank you. Mr. Kaplan, under your going back to the Facility Siting Council and your spreadsheet here of the facilities that are under review for site certificate and under review for amendment for site certificate, there appears to be about 1,400 megawatts of natural gas and about 3,000 of wind megawatts. Given that many of the best locations for wind turbines have been already put up, and the likelihood that the production tax credit may go away, and a number of other factors, I wonder if you could give the committee some idea of the relative unsubsidized cost and efficiency of those wind projects as opposed to the natural gas projects. And I don't, you know, perhaps you could provide that to us, but I mean, it's something I think we should be looking at. We're continuing to put windmills up all over Eastern Oregon. at quite a high expense. Certainly, the wind is inexpensive when it is an inexpensive form of fuel, but somehow those windmills don't seem to be able to run without a tax credit. So I'm wondering why we're doing that. I mean, why are we? What kind of analysis is the Department of Energy going through to determine that these are appropriate and are going to give a return on investment and be an appropriate investment for the state?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, we'd be happy to follow up with you on that question. That's a pretty expansive one. So we'll get to the heart of that and follow up with you.
Thank you.
Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you go back, Director, to the slide that shows the ESA portion of the 15-17 budget? Back another. Right there. Perhaps you can explain the differences in the proportions of each of those areas when it comes to ESA funding.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Benz, by and large, most of our programs are fee recovery. So there are fees charged for our tax credits, for example. The applicants for site certificates are charged fees. We also have federal grants. Where you see the most ESA is where there are not fees that could be charged for that work. So, for example, you see a lot of it in administrative services because while we charge our programs for our work, my work, for example, there's not a fee that we charge for it other than the ESA. So that's why you see that distribution.
Follow up. It's a filler then. You have so much fees. You have a budget. You have so much for fees, and then what's left, in comes the ESA.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Benz, we are supposed to, by statute, consider every other source of revenue before we go to ESA. So ESA does serve as the backbone after everything else is filled in.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Following up on Representative Benz's line of questioning, fees are supposed to be for services rendered. So if you're just using it as a filler for where you don't have enough funds somewhere else, how does that comport with what the purpose of the fee is?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, the fees that we have for our other programs are cost recovery. So the fee that we're paying, or that ESA is paying, is for the work that we're doing on behalf of the state. So my time, our communications time, our government relations time, we can't, those fees that support the enactment of energy policy of the legislature and the programs that we operate are what ESA goes towards. So where we have an opportunity to recover those costs, we do when there's a direct beneficiary, for example, a developer of a siting project, for example. But there are siting costs, a perfect example being the work that's being done on the indirect impact, the cumulative impact of transmission lines in the Umatilla area and that overlap with high value ag. That's a policy question that we're working on that does not have a direct fee payer on the development side that we can charge for that work. Given that it's statewide impact, that is something that is funded with ESA, for example.
Sounds more like a tax, isn't it?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, that is a question that's being asked of the courts right now.
Other questions for the director? Not seeing any. Mike, I want to thank you again for your presentation, and just a note, also want to thank your department for allowing a few of us to go up to Hanford and review the operations the state participates in up there. Found it quite interesting, and there's a lot of important things going on up there. So thanks for
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you very much. We appreciate the time.
Committee, I did skip something at the beginning of the meeting because not everyone was here, but we did want to make sure that if anybody had any follow-up information or requests from the previous meeting, that give you a moment to reflect upon that, and if you have anything to talk about from those requests from the previous meeting. Doesn't appear so. And that information was sent to us by our committee administrator, so you can always look at it in the future if you haven't had time to yet. So without further ado, I think we're ready to move into a little short committee discussion. I guess in the past meetings, as you all know, we've been really going through the department program by program, looking at the information the department's given us about that, asking questions, and we're wrapping that portion of this committee's work up and want to pivot now to looking at potential recommendations, potential comments from that. And so our next step is going to be soliciting those recommendations from stakeholders, and also we're going to be trying to work with the individual committee members to get their thoughts. The co-chair Beyer and I will be contacting you probably in this next month, and hopefully have a couple of conversations with you before ahead of our next meeting. So having said that, we also wanted to make sure that all the stakeholders got an opportunity to give us their recommendations. We've obviously met with some of the utilities who have, you know, offered some thoughts about that and some recommendations about that. And I don't know that we have made any of that those recommendations formal or as part of this committee documentation yet, but we'll be pursuing to do that. And so wanted to just alert the utilities and other stakeholders that we would like to share their recommendations on the public record. And so we'll be working to accomplish some of that in this next month, and really hope that other stakeholders will be, of course, we've received a lot of public comment, some testimony that is already on the record. But if you have recommendations for the agency, we'd like to sort of get those recommendations down to the specific program area and really discuss, you know, what it is you're recommending that we change and why, and you know, what your solution or recommendation points us to. So just trying to keep this consistent so we can look at the specific program areas and really try to compile our recommendations specific to those program areas. It'll make it much more expedient for us to look at those in those sorts of groups. Of course, there could be other recommendations that may not fit into a program area, so we're going to have an other category as well besides the specific program areas. And I know our committee administrator is working with us to develop a sort of a spreadsheet, if you will, on the different program areas, and we're going to diligently go through each one of them as to what people have told us they think their recommendations are. So we're hoping to get those recommendations by August 15th of this next month, now that we've spent this great deal of time going through the programs. That'll give this committee time to really digest some of those recommendations. So get those recommendations to our committee administrator, Beth Petrino, myself, or co-chair Beyer. Our next meeting is going to be August 29th, and hopefully we'll have time at that meeting to review many of these recommendations and ask questions about them. And so that's kind of how we're going to proceed to the next meeting. Something to add to that, co-chair Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, I would we spent a lot of time listing program by program, but I think to put it all in context, I would encourage you to, in the next couple of weeks, to go back and read ORS Chapter 469. There's a lot of policy language there. There's a lot of directives to the department that kind of puts things together a little better. And perhaps more importantly, to the extent that we decide to make recommendations to change that, it's going to require legislation that'll be, could be major changes in policy, and I think it's good to understand where it came from.
Absolutely. That's a definitely a good point to look at the statutes as well. So any questions about that? Seeing anything else. So I think we'll just go ahead.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Beth a question? I've got two sets of questions answered here. One of them has to do with the energy incentive tax credits. Apparently there's between outstanding, and apparently there's between of those that are issued and those that are in the works, about $54 million. But then on this other sheet, it talks about what is our outstanding Betsy liability, and that is at a little over $1 billion. Are those additive, or?
You know, I'll have to check with the department, Senator. I don't know, but if I can see what you're looking at. Yeah. Okay, why don't I talk with them, and I'll get back to you, if that's okay. I'll just write this down.
So, also, when I'm speaking to the making recommendations around the specific programs, I'm going to have Beth go back. We've got the, you know, different divisions of the agency listed, but we'll have a breakout, I think, in our one of our early meetings. I'm trying to remember which one this was, our first one perhaps. We had a division of all the different programs within each of the divisions, which will be very helpful for us and for the stakeholders to really, you know, dial in on which program they'd like to see changes or recommend changes to. So that will be a useful tool, and I'm hopeful that Beth will be able to reiterate something similar to that on OLIS, and I don't know what we'll call it, stakeholder recommendations or something like that, so you can see where, you know, how we want to format these recommendations and around these different program areas. So having said that, I'm just trying to make that a little bit more clear for people. Anything else from the dais? Not seeing. So let's go ahead and move into public comment. I don't know that we have anyone on the phone today.
Nope.
So up first, we have Irene Gilbert. Traveling from more than 100 miles away yet again.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, we meet again. Irene Gilbert, 2310 Adams Avenue, La Grande, Oregon, representing Friends of the Grand Ronde Valley. I'm also a member of the Blue Mountain Alliance. And first I wanted to just make a statement about, I believe it was Senator Whitsitt asked about the comparison between wind and other types of energy in terms of resources and output. Sounds like a sort of a balance of what's it costing and what are we getting out of it. And I was just reading an article within the last week where they looked at the energy use that is needed in order to generate the wind turbines, produce them, transport them, build them, do site prep. And basically this group said that it takes the life of a wind turbine to recover the energy that is used in producing a wind turbine. So I think that's something that's worth looking at when you're approving or pushing for wind energy sites. Now, I can probably find that article if you folks would like to see it. But and I don't know that it was scientific, but I think it is an issue that needs to be looked at. I provided written comments, and I'll try not to repeat those. However, I would say that I've already moved into looking at fixes, and one of the recommendations that I made had to do with consolidating programs and the need to not have so many different programs with so many different rules and regulations. And It appears to me that over time the legislature has taken something of a shotgun approach to dealing with these issues of that affect the Department of Energy. And so it seems like every time a concern came up, there was a new statute that created a new program. And during the during my information that I provided to the committee, I gave you an example of one situation where I was talking about the cost of energy loss based on residences. And as a trainer, which I spent many years as a trainer, with the exception of like a year that I spent filling in for Larry Nicewender at the Workers' Comp Division, I did a lot of working with subject matter experts to help them put together training, and I think that some of the things that I learned from that apply to this group. And one of the primary activities that I participated in was helping those subject matter experts focus on what it was they wanted to accomplish, because there's sort of a need to solve every problem for everybody along the way. And I think that particularly when it comes to energy, if the legislature would focus on what is your primary goal, you would get further by consolidating programs and dealing with an issue that really is going to make a difference. And so another example besides the one that I provided about residences would be when it comes to the issue of alternative energy vehicles, because I found 8 different incentives related to reduction of the carbon use of vehicles, and there are 17 separate statutes and rules related to this particular desire to reduce the amount of carbon emissions from vehicles. I would like to see those programs consolidated into one program that identifies what is it you want to accomplish and put your money into something that you can measure and know that you're getting something, and the taxpayers are getting something for the money that they're spending on those programs. So that was one fix that I suggested. Another one is I'd like to have you keep in mind that you have a Department of Energy now that is dealing with every facet of siting of energy facilities. And many people in the public, and I'm assuming many of you on this board, have considered the fact that siting of energy facilities is particularly problematic with this agency. What I would like you to keep in mind is the number of complaints that you have received. And you heard the director of the Department of Energy tell you that he didn't know where contested case hearings were supposed to go in the event that the department refused to hear a request for a contested case. I have denials that specifically say that in order to deal with that denial of being willing to hear the case, that I had to go to the Oregon Supreme Court. He indicated that the courts were the ones to decide an issue such as this, and yet when I asked for a contested case to clarify what the courts want, I was denied the opportunity to have that. The Department of Energy and the Energy Facility Siting Council apparently require or want the courts to decide issues of policy, and yet they make it impossible for the public to access the legal process. Another example worth noting, the administrative rules in 345.001.0035 reflect the requirement in the statute which says, the chair shall appoint an electromagnetic field committee composed of public utilities, manufacturers, and state agencies. The committee shall monitor information available and being developed on the health effects of exposure to low-frequency electric and magnetic fields and report periodically to the council. The council will then report that information to the legislature. Now, the Boardman to Hemingway transmission line is in process. The Department of Energy has the preliminary application already. There have been multiple comments from the public concerning electromagnetic fields, primarily because Oregon standard is much, allows a much greater exposure than many other states and other countries. Now, the Department of Energy spent months, literally, when I brought up the need for this committee, trying to figure out, I guess, how to deal with it. They ended up having an executive session with their attorney and determined that since they had had one of these committees years ago, they had met the statutory requirement that I just read to you, and there was no need for them to have any further involvement with that committee. Now, in 2009, they hired a specific consultant to look at this issue. In that consultant's report, he referenced the fact that when the committee had met, their recommendation was that they have ongoing monitoring. His recommendation was that there be ongoing monitoring. So I'm just trying to figure out why the Department of Energy would spend that kind of energy trying to avoid meeting the statute to have a committee that could deal with the reality that there are going to be contested case requests as a result of the electromagnetic field issue. It's something that the public is very concerned with. And so I guess I just, I don't understand why the department puts energy into avoiding meeting the statutes, and how can the public trust an agency to be running contested cases when they are willing to put that level of energy into avoiding meeting the statutes. Now, I don't know how many times I have seen responses that say the Department of Energy doesn't consider that an issue, or the result would not be significant, or these really kind of, I don't know, just generalized statements about making a decision that the department is right and the person asking for contested case is incorrect without ever hearing the case. So my recommendation, and I urge you, I think it's one of the most important things that you could do as a committee, would be to remove the evaluation, the contested case issues, from under the authority of the Department of Energy. My recommendation would be that it go to LCDC, because these site certificates are really about land use and land use planning, and it would be a fairly easy matter to move the contested cases into an agency that already has experience in land use planning issues. So that's sort of the extent of my comment. You'll probably hear more recommendations. Like I said, I'm trying to be very specific on what the issues are and what my recommendation would be, how I view current conditions, and what I think could be accomplished by the change. So I hope you see that reflected in my written comments. I hope you hear that from me in my verbal comments. Do you have any questions?
Thank you for your comments today. I appreciate them.
Okay. Thank you.
Up next, let's have John Audley and Brad Hunter.
Morning, folks.
Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
On behalf of Kraft 3, my name is John Audley. I live and work out of Portland, Oregon. As many of you know, my consulting work focuses on building rural community economic health. And in that vein, I'm proud to serve as Kraft 3's representative in Salem and also in Olympia, especially at a time when they are expanding their offices to serve a wider range of rural communities. While you deliberate ODOT's future, there does seem to be consensus around one aspect of your charge, namely the future administration of whatever investment and incentive programs you choose to continue. I've spoken with many of you informally about a big idea, namely a public-private partnership designed to bring new investments in small business and consumers across a range of energy generation and energy efficiency goals that are consistent with the state's own vision for an energy future. So I've asked Senior Vice President Brad Hunter to come and speak to you today more formally about this idea. So, Brad.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chairs Beyer and Holvey, for this opportunity. Again, my name is Brad Hunter. I'm a Vice President with Craft 3, based out of the Portland office. And today I want to share some history with you about our relationships in Washington State, forming a public-private partnership really designed to speed up investment in clean energy in the state. So I want to provide that as a backdrop for recommendations we have as ODO and the legislature looks forward to what is the future of clean energy investment in the state. So I want to start with just a brief background on who Craft 3 is to put us in perspective. We're a nonprofit, mission-based lender that provides financing to businesses, nonprofits, and individuals in Oregon and Washington. We have a 23-year history of investing almost $400 million, again, in businesses and nonprofits, individuals that can't access traditional credit. This is a key part of our mission. We don't compete with banks. We provide a segment of the business population with financing that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. To put this in perspective and on the ground, several of our recent transactions to highlight, one was with Fry Foods in Ontario. This was a $10 million loan that we provided for a food manufacturing facility to reopen in that in Ontario. We created 124 jobs, and we're very proud of that transaction. Another one is Wallowa Lake Lodge. We provided almost $1 million to a local community group who had formed to acquire the lodge, to preserve it as a community asset as well as an environmental asset. So we're very proud of the impacts we have in the two state regions. We're also very proud of our fiscal management. We've historically run less than 2% loss, which we think speaks highly of our ability to manage other people's money. In terms of the public-private partnership in Washington, we've got had a long-term relationship with the Department of Commerce in Washington, starting back in 2012 with the Small Business Credit Initiative. We have since expanded that when the governor and the legislature decided to provide money for what they called their Clean Energy Fund 1. This was direct funds that were made available for a number of different things, including seed capital for the startup of what has now become our Future Energy Fund. The state provided, in a competitive award, provided Craft 3 $8.7 million to seed this fund. This was grant capital that was awarded to Craft 3 to invest in commercial and industrial energy efficiency, small-scale renewable energy, as well as what we call clean tech manufacturing, so manufacturing facilities that contribute to the clean tech economy. The goal of this fund and the reason that we're excited about it is because it drives state dollars as well as private dollars into small businesses in the state that are focused on clean energy. It has a specific target. It's managed by a third party, obviously us, which provides transparency to both the legislature and the public. It also, a couple of important things, it allows, by putting that money with a third party, it allows that money to be leveraged. So we can go out and raise additional funds that then capitalizes a larger loan pool for these businesses. And again, I think it's important to note that the transactions, and we've done to date, we've done 13 transactions for a total of about $12.5 million. And again, that's a range of commercial energy efficiency as well as small-scale renewable energy. Just an important piece on this, again, is that ability to leverage outside money and to work creatively and flexibly with potential clients in transactions and businesses that couldn't attract traditional credit. So in Craft 3's estimation, these transactions would not happen without our financing and without the state's involvement. So with that as a background, our recommendation to the legislature as you think about the future of the Department of Energy and specifically the SELP program, what to do with business financing is a two-pronged approach. The first is to do an audit of the existing portfolio, specifically the private side of this, not is what we're focused on is the private side. So an audit of that, a credit quality, really to get an understanding of what are the loans behind that, are they performing, or is the financial reporting up to date, And what's the estimated value of that fund? Because the second part of that is we're recommending that the state look at selling that fund, packaging it as a single entity to sell to basically to the highest bidder. This allows a clean slate for the program. And the second part of our recommendation is for the state to look at allocating additional resources to mirror what we've done in Washington, provide seed funding competitively to a third party to manage on behalf of the state. And again, the key reasons for that: transparency, the ability to leverage outside dollars, and the flexibility of a third party to deliver that financing in an effective, cost-effective manner. So I thank the committee for their time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you. Could you speak to transparency? Lending money to a third party that's not governmental, not a governmental agency, doesn't feel more transparent to me. So could you speak to that, please?
Yeah. So again, we have a 23-year track record. We have annual audits. We're also audited by CARS, which is a nationwide benchmark for the types of organizations we are. So we have multiple layers of transparency that's public that we put on our website. We're also able to provide, obviously, internal interim reporting that provides as much transparency as anyone.
And if I may, Co-Chair Senator Edwards, the legislature stipulate the conditions of an award and articulate exactly what kind of reporting requirements, what kind of information needs to be communicated back to the administering agency. Our experience is that the activities of the third party can, in fact, be that much more transparent and with all due respect, insulated, if you will, from the political persuasions of agencies and heads of state as with regard to how those monies are spent or invested in the first place.
Senator Beyer.
Two questions, Mr. Chair. One is Crabtree, is that right?
Correct.
Are you an EDC, federal designee? Economic Development Corporation?
We are a community development financial institution, correct, designated by the Treasurer.
Okay, so we have a few of those around. The second one is, can you contrast how your organization works with the Energy Trust?
We do have a long relationship with the Energy Trust. That's primarily been on our residential loan side. We were the original formation for Clean Energy Works, which is now a statewide delivery mechanism for home energy efficiency. So that's our primary relationship with Energy Trust. On the commercial side, we have informal relationships with them, but not a formal one, to my knowledge.
So you were involved in Clean Energy Works?
Craft 3 was, yes, sir.
Okay.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. A couple of questions, actually. As I understood your scenario, the state of Washington gave you $8.7 million to start a fund, and you leveraged the money and then loaned it out to the private sector for energy development. So in case of default, is Craft 3 responsible for the loss or the state?
Well, the state money in this case is a form of a grant. So that comes onto our balance sheet. It basically serves as equity. So when we take a loss, Craft 3 is taking that loss. That money we don't have recourse back to the state to repay that. That is a grant, a long-term investment in Craft 3. But it is.
So the state has no exposure to default then?
Exactly.
Okay. Second question you're talking about on the audit of the private SELP loans and estimated value in the sale, there would be a significant loss to the state on a discounted sale that would have to be made up somewhere. Do you have some idea how that would work?
I think our opinion on it is to see it clearly, see that portfolio clearly. Now, the decision to sell it obviously is a tougher one depending on the quality of that of those assets. And so I don't unfortunately have an idea of if it was sold at a discount where that those funds would be made up. But I think the important thing is to understand what you have because they are assets.
And if I may, Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, It seems like a healthy idea to get an independent party to assess the value of the portfolio, and then the legislature, the state is faced with a difficult decision. If there's a delta between your estimated value and what you have on the books, do you realize that loss and deal with it, or do you try and figure out a way to push it down the road? I respectfully submit, and as an Oregonian, would ask you to just realize it and get on with a better program.
Anything else?
Just one follow up. Do you have any idea what a third party evaluation would cost?
That's a good question. I think it would be how thorough it would be, but it would. I would imagine
to make a decision.
I would think to get a reputable firm to do it. It would be expensive. Probably, I'm just going to guess in sort of $20,000-$25,000, maybe more.
Did we do it for?
We did do it informally for the Department of Commerce, but I'd have to look back to see what that what we charged them. It was a smaller loan fund. They had numerous small loan funds that they managed.
For $25,000.
We're guessing.
That's roughly. Please don't quote me, because we're not. Let me clarify. We're not in the business.
No, I appreciate that.
Direct business.
I was thinking more like you were going to say $25 million.
I would hope not.
But that's something that, Mr. Chair, might be something to be really worthwhile for us to do or to recommend, simply because we know that SILT program is in trouble, but we don't know how much trouble it's in, and I'm not sure that it's being evaluated by independently thinking people. So, you know, I think it might be maybe wise to do that.
Jim Fade and the Treasurer.
Secretary of State. Thank you, gentlemen. I don't see any other comments, questions. I appreciate you coming forward. I have to think about the public partner relationship and what the return on investment to the state is, sort of is a question in my mind. If I assume there's no liability to the state because we're not getting anything back, we're not making an investment, we're just providing a grant for whatever policy you're trying to achieve for the state, which I assume would be clean energy.
And I think we would look, Chair, at that return on investment as job creation, business growth around clean energy in the state. So there are solid returns on that investment.
Again, whether or not a Craft 3 is in this hypothetical situation is awarded a competitive grant or, you know, program administration. One of the things I'm particularly proud of representing Craft 3 is that when you look at its annual report, its benchmarks are quite specific. Jobs created, jobs retained, dollars invested, identify the community. So all those questions about where the money went, how it was spent, what the overhead was, they're very clearly spelled out. And that's what you can ask for as conditions for an award should you choose to go this route. Those kinds of benchmarks are clearly within the reach of organizations like Craft 3, and it isn't just Craft 3 that's capable of doing this kind of stuff.
Well, thank you for being
here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, Randy Camp and Joe Westby. Good morning, gentlemen. You'd just introduce yourself for the record before you give your testimony.
Good morning, co-chairs Byron Hovey and the rest of the committee here. My name is Randy Camp. I'm with CoEnergy Propane. We're a small, independent, locally owned and operated propane provider with offices in Albany and Redmond. And I want to talk a little bit about the ESA and how it's unfair to my company and other propane companies in the state of Oregon. The propane industry is made up of a variety of different types of companies, national, regional, and then locally owned, like myself, and it's a very competitive market. We are regulated not by the Department of Energy, but by the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office. We have no other nexus with the Department of Energy. We don't need site certificates from them as an example. When the department began to include our industry in the ESA, we were told that they determined how this was to be done by a phone survey where they called all the propane companies and asked them one question. That question was, do you sell propane to others who sell propane to the public? Since Coenergy sells propane to others like gas stations who then sell propane to the consuming public in gas grill tanks, motorhomes, travel trailers, that kind of stuff, our answer was yes. Because we answered yes, we're being assessed the ESA. This makes it an unlevel playing field as other marketers who don't sell to those type of people don't have to pay ESA. The gas is sold to the ESA is actually assessed twice in many cases. The wholesalers who provide it to us in the first place pay the ESA fee also. If we have to deal with the ESA, in my opinion, it would be better to assess the fee once to the true wholesalers, as the Department of Environmental Quality does on its greenhouse gas regulations. Personally, I don't think we should be paying ESA. Another point that I would like to bring up that makes it unfair treatment is that it affects not just the propane we sell to the people who sell it to the consuming public. We are assessed ESA on everything we sell, our gross sales, with the exception of motor fuel and tank rent. So if one of you were to stop at my office and buy a bottle of barbecue sauce or a grill cover, I'm paying ESA on that. It includes parts and fittings, labor, and so on. It's not just propane. And I really doubt that the utilities have to pay such a broad assessment on this part of their ESA. The Pacific Propane and Gas Association, which Joe and I are both officers in, has met three times in the past with the Department of Energy and discussed this with them, but nothing's ever changed. I'm sure part of that has to do with the fact that the personnel has changed almost every time we've met with them. But we're here today and in hopes that you can help us with this inequity in the way that ESA is being assessed. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Joe Westby. I'm the Oregon Director for the National Propane Gas Association. I'm also the chair for the Oregon Government Affairs Committee, and I'm also the director of operations for Feral Gas Propane here in the state of Oregon. We are a larger, major propane reseller across the United States with many different offices and entities throughout the state of Oregon. We proudly serve all the communities. Just to add a little bit of color onto Randy's testimony here, as far as the unfair treatment of this, you know, when we take a look at everything we're being assessed upon, if you were to walk into your local Coast to Coast or True Value Hardware and purchase a flex line and a gas shutoff and maybe a few pieces of pipe and different fittings for hooking up a gas water heater, no ESA. If you come into our office, purchase that same thing, ESA. Standard TV and appliance might sell an oven control valve to a commercial customer such as a restaurant. No ESA. If they come in and buy it at Feral Gas or Coenergy, ESA. We're also, like I said, we're a major company. We do have a true wholesale department. So a company like ours is actually assessed twice. We're assessed at our wholesale level, and then we're assessed at our retail level because we were one of those companies that also answered yes when it came to the question as far as do you sell propane to a retailer who in turn sells to the public. And we do have many different retail operations out there ranging from, you know, your local Chevron station to Bob's Tackle Shop. So our company is basically being hit twice for this assessment. And I just recently paid for our northern offices, our northern businesses, quite a bill. And it's significantly higher than it was before. I believe last year we were paying to the tune of about $13,000. based upon our grossed revenue. This last year it was surpassing 20 grand. So this has definitely caught the attention of some of our corporate financial people asking what's going on, where does this go, for which I don't have any answers. So,
Co-Chair Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be clear. You're saying that people who wholesale to you are paying it?
Chair Holvey, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, that's correct. Yes.
Hmm. Chair Holvey, Beyer, and committee, if I may, if I was to buy, and I can buy my propane from his company through his wholesale division, his wholesale division pays ESA, which in turn charges it to me as an upcharge, and then I pay it when I sell it to the public.
Yeah, what you're saying is it's different than petroleum, which is just paid for once.
Correct.
At the wholesale.
Exactly.
Representative Heck.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Question as it relates to the benefit you get for paying the ESA. What do you feel that you get from the department for paying that ESA?
Representative Hack, in my opinion, we get nothing. We have no nexus whatsoever with the Department of Energy.
Thank you.
My only contact with the Department of Energy is once a year when I talk to them about why I'm paying this.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
And this is going to be a, this is a weighted question. Do you think this is a fee or a tax?
Senator Olson, in my opinion, a fee, as I understand it, a fee is something that you pay when you're getting something in return. I get nothing in return, so in my opinion, it's a tax.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you testifying today, and hope you have a good morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
And up next, Bill Kluding.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, Chair Beyer, Committee. For the record, Bill Kluding, Carpenters and Joiners America. I sent you a short note, but I'm here again today, and again, thank you for allowing me to testify. There is talk of doing away with the Department of Energy. I myself, I'm against that. I think it's needed. Now, again, does it need to be scaled back? Does it need to come under stringent controls by the legislative group? I think yes. There's been fixes before, but they seem to find a way around it. Again, I think some fixes are in order, or else we wouldn't be here today at this meeting. Two items I'll talk about. And you've heard me discuss this before, is woody biomass. We need the Department of Energy with help on woody biomass. Science is now proven. Facts are coming out. Laws are being passed in Washington, D.C. that woody biomass is a renewable energy source. If we're going to control greenhouse gases, this is one step we're going to have to take. Very labor intensive. I'll give you a couple examples. Last year, 6.1 million tons of woody pellets was exported out of North America. All that came out of Canada and three southeast states. Sadly, Oregon was not part of this. We have an unlimited supply of woody biomass in this state. Not only does it create jobs for rural Oregon, but again, we have to get a handle on this if we're going to control the amount of greenhouse gases that's going up into our atmosphere and what burns in forest fires we can't tolerate what we've had in the past. The second little item is a vast amount of this state has a hammer holding over their head. And that's juniper problem. U.S. Fish and Wildlife are on the verge. They can at any time. There's lawsuits pending to classify the sage hen as an endangered species. This will cripple what's left of rural Oregon. Again, juniper is a very labor-intensive operation. We gained a little bit last session, but we have found out that the payback is not there. Very few juniper trees make a decent lumber. Most of it has to be chipped or piled and burned. But again, it's very critical. Juniper is starving the vast area of this state for water. One small tree, 50 gallons of water a day. It's been proven when they clean these hillsides up, get the juniper out of there, water again returns to these little streams. And I'll just stop right there. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kluding. And I quote you as stringent controls by the legislature. I've been here 5 years. I know you've been around longer than that. Have you ever seen that?
Well, from problems in the past, I don't want to go into that. You folks, that's hanging over your head. But I do think when there's X amount of dollars, then that figure should be arrived at by this body that Ways and Means steps in and determines whether this is a doable venture for Oregon.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Bill, just to follow up on what you're saying, just a comment. In the Klamath Basin, at 20 juniper trees per acre and 50 gallons of water for 5 months out of the year, per day for 5 months out of the year, the juniper forest in the Klamath Basin are using more water than runs down the Klamath River at Iron Gate Dam peak. So you're absolutely right. I mean, they're a weed, they're an invasive species, and they need to be eliminated.
Again, committee, Oregon's going to have to step forward on these two problems. We've been asking for help for years. We could have had cogen facilities, but again, it's going to cost money. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today, Bill. Thank you. That brings us to the end of our the agenda I have. Is there anything else, Beth? Is there anybody else that would like to provide public comment? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Our next meeting, August
29th.
And I think the committee members may expect to get an email from the co-chairs before that happens. So with that, I will adjourn the committee on Oregon Department of Energy Oversight Committee.
So is that?
Oversight Committee.
So is that?
Oregon Department of Energy.